The long hair is gone. The passion remains. Kyle Turley, for a minute there, I would say he was sort of the poster child for the bad boy of the NFL. Maybe a modern day Conrad Dover. The visual of him chucking the helmet. I think it was a Jets player. He's got the crazy blonde hair flying, says whatever he wants. And that same Kyle Turley, who was on the Saints, was a rival of the Rams, ended up coming to St. Louis, and famously behind the reporter, hopped up and said, "Mark Bulger's our quarterback." He explains that a little bit. It wasn't a shot at Kurt Warner. It was sort of a weird time to be in the Rams locker room because Warner was the Super Bowl hero, the two-time MVP, and yet Mark Bulger was taking over as the team's QB, and Turley explains that. What it was like playing for Mike Ditka and then later working with Mike Ditka with some of the gridiron greats, helping those who had retired from the NFL, were having health problems. Turley was always one who was willing to take on the league, poke the bear, which I know folks in St. Louis, considering the current lawsuit going on, happy that anybody at any time was willing to challenge the NFL. Kyle Turley also fell out of favor with Mike Martz. Just a fascinating, interesting guy. We became friends during his time in St. Louis, have kept in touch. He was living in California, has long been a proponent of CBD, medical marijuana. And he's like, dude, it's not just people sitting around getting high. There's a lot of benefits here. And some of that had to do with how he was, what he would tell you, sort of forced a bunch of pain pills to deal with all of his football injuries. And then you get hooked on those pain pills. And he really goes beyond the NFL world and says, current day America, just dependency on these pills and the opioid problems we're having all over the place. He's an interesting spokesperson on all of this because he's been through it. So Kyle Turley is the guest on the Kilcoin Conversation. We taped this a little while back, and then things kept coming up. Blues segments, Cardinals segments, Cardinals news. But I always enjoy my time with Kyle. He tells it like it is, doesn't care who he may or may not offend, lives life by his own rules, that is for sure. But some of these topics, even the Mike Martz, the Kurt Warner, he and I never really gotten into all of that. So hopefully you will enjoy it. As always, it's presented by Triad Bank, St. Louis-based bank since 2005. Five-star rated bank. If you need a car loan, a home loan, make sure you check out the fine folks at Triad Bank in Frontenac, right there on Clayton Road. Easy to get to because it's right by Highway 40 and Lindbergh. So you get right off the highway, you'll find my good friends at Triad Bank. The best in the bricks. That slogan is catchy, but it's also true. B&G Tuck Pointing can take that chimney, garage, the entire home, the business, if it's brick, make it look new again. That's what they do at B&G Tuck Pointing. 363-0525, the phone number to call. Get a free estimate. 314-363-0525 or their website, bgtuckpointing.com. See some of the work that they've done. They also do foundation repair, waterproofing, all things bricks and home. They've got you covered. bgtuckpointing.com. Marie DeVilla Senior Living, corner of Clayton and Weidman Road, Villa Estates, assisted living, whatever type of retirement living you're looking for, they have it at Marie DeVilla. Take a virtual tour at mariedevilla.com. Since 1960, like I said many times, Red Shandings lived there. He was on the board. It's just a beautiful spot in West County, 60-acre campus, Marie DeVilla. Also, Appliance Discounters, theappliancediscounters.com is where you can begin the search or stop by any of their showrooms throughout the area. And what we always recommend, check out the merchandise online. Go into the search engine, and you can just type it in right there. We're talking about washer, dryer, stove, refrigerator. But if you're looking for any of those appliances, I always recommend General Electric. Get a GE rebate. When it's GE, you know you're getting the best. Years and years of making the best appliances and throwing the rebate, you know you're getting a great deal already at Appliance Discounters. And because they've got the inventory, they can get it delivered to you quickly. TheAppliancediscounters.com. Their savings are your savings. And here it is, my conversation with Kyle Turley.
Hey, Kyle, I want to start with this. Last time I talked to you, you were in Cali, and now you're back in Nashville. You'd lived in Nashville for a while. Tell me about the move.
Yeah. Well, we lived here Post-career, 07, end of 06 season, we came out here. I thought I was done with football in 06, in my first year comeback with the Chiefs. It was a painful year. And I didn't think I was coming back. So we moved out here. My wife's from West Tennessee. And we moved back here, found a beautiful home. You know, I had no idea. I was in New Orleans. I was in St. Louis, Kansas City. I thought the South, especially, you know, I mean, my wife's town where she's from in Tennessee, and West Tennessee, is real small. And the area and the terrain is just, you know, flat. So I thought that that's what Nashville would be. But when I came here, it's not. It's beautiful. Rolling hills. You know, it's the foothills of the Smokies. So it's a beautiful place to live. And obviously, you know, raising a family, things like that, that we were just about to get into. You know, we hadn't started that process yet. And so that was on our minds as to where we wanted to raise a family. And when I saw this place, when she brought me out here, when she said, hey, come try Nashville, see what you think. I was in. Unfortunately, that football career caught up with me and all those injuries, and forced us out of Nashville 7 years ago and back to California.
And so in the music scene, was that part of it when you were in Nashville? Was it a little bit because of music?
Well, just music was always a part of my life. I mean, even when I was there in St. Louis, you know, we had the benefit concerts that we would do over there at the Maristar, and, you know, every training camp, I'd be getting a room full of music equipment, you know, to rock out with everybody and see who else on the team was a musician. And you'd always find a person for every instrument, you know. So music was always a part of my life. And then, you know, Nashville, done with football, I had to figure something out to do with my time. And you know, riding a tractor, I already did that when I up until I was 10 out west living on a farm. So I knew how that was. I didn't have a desire to put in all that hard work out in the field outside of, you know, getting my yard put together and little projects. So you know, I had to do something when I was here, and music obviously was right in front of me. I started going around to all the, from the Bluebird to Leaper's Fork and everywhere, and Puckett's, and all the places that people go out here to see live music, and these songwriter things where you just, you know, you're sitting there with a guitar playing songs with Elvis Costello. Like, it doesn't happen anywhere else, you know?
Yeah, I heard a recent podcast. So Chris Long, former Rams player, has gotten really into podcasting, and he had a long form interview with Ricky Williams, and he's talking about everything he went through and sort of social anxiety and how kind of the pot thing got mislabeled. And it was really interesting. And I'm thinking, now, wait a minute, you guys would have been teammates in New Orleans. And I thought the similarity would be that the league kind of likes to put everybody into a box, and you're just supposed to fall in line. And if you're really a unique person or have some personality, or maybe you're just have a different way of thinking, like, the league doesn't necessarily allow for that, or at least it didn't then. Is that, do you see any similarities there?
Yeah. And yet they put us together. You know, we just, I've uniquely reconnected with so many ex teammates that, you know, you can say there's, a lot to say for that. And also that they wanted these things that are happening right now to happen, you know, in a way. They do, they don't, you know, from being told that, Kyle, we really like what you're doing with Mike Ditka and the Gridiron Greats, you know, to, Kyle, thank you for, you know, informing us, enlightening us on this plant. You know, and these are words coming from the top, you know? And so, I don't know, man. I've got a different perspective on life now, being a bit older and stepping back a little bit and having that opportunity to take those glasses off of being in the NFL. You know, you started it off, you know, the new life after the NFL. You guys have had to do that as a media in St. Louis, you know, and find new paths for your purpose. And I just know that's why I'm here.
Do you feel vindicated in any way that, you know, marijuana, especially medical marijuana, it's become mainstream? Even cannabis use has become very mainstream. And maybe 10 years ago, it still had the stigma attached. And you were saying, listen, for guys, especially who had had severe injuries or brain injuries, I mean, you were an advocate before it was popular. Do you feel that you won the war in any way?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the train's left the station. it's going, and federal legalization is about to happen. So, you know, all the states, I'm back in Tennessee now to get my kids back in school and live an American life while we can, I guess, you know, for the time being. I was just out in California because all my businesses wasn't really a good time for me to move. You know, I just started two companies out there in cannabis and, you know, fought for all this licensing and all these city council meetings with my partner. And, you know, I've got a couple brands in the space out there that are doing really well and keep me busy. I'm on the airplane going back and forth, but had to move back here to Tennessee. And the irony of that is I just got off the phone right before I answered your call. I just got off the phone with the, you know, the county sheriff because, you know, I reached out because I'm wanting to talk to him about how is he perceiving this. You know, as a medical patient, being up front 100% and respecting that he'll enforce the law and I'll have to be an outlaw in some ways, but that these things are already known, that he's representing to me that medical is going to happen here in Tennessee within the next 2 years. And obviously federal legalization is going to occur here before that. So, you know, as he also, you know, acknowledged. And so this is something I think that's, you know, down the road and one of those issues that they really only care about when it links it to other bad things. And, you know, still with the situation in America with majority states just kind of in it, not full recreational, even California, unbelievably restrictive. You wouldn't believe how restrictive. Over 80% of cities are under banned status from participating in the legal cannabis markets. Very backwards. And while you have those things exist and states like Tennessee that, you know, are not allowing it still, or, you know, being the last flag, I guess. And then, you know, other states right next to them, Virginia, just completely legalizing recreational cannabis without a retail opportunity and people providing that. You're just encouraging the black market like never before. And all my friends that, you know, did it and spent plenty of time in prison are not afraid and are doing it again and making millions. So, you know, it's the writing on the wall kind of thing here where everybody's just kind of, I think if you're not attached to something really bad with it, then people understand that this is something helping a lot of people. And when you see professional athletes that say, I've not taken one pharmaceutical in 7 years, not an aspirin or an Aleve, I've been diagnosed with stage 2 progressive dementia 3 years ago. So, you know, I recognize the cognitive issues, as does my family. And they can all attest as well as I do still to this day that cannabis is the answer.
So how is your health these days? How are you feeling?
Healthy. I mean, I've not gotten sick. I feel I had the COVID. I lost the taste and smell. I was down for about a week or two, but every year you get something like that kind of puts you down a bit. I've not had one problem coming out of it, and that's through using cannabis. And that goes down to my family. You know, CBD, I started my CBD company years ago in the beginning of this whole conversation as I discovered it myself, and I have all my family on it, and not one person in my family's died of this. And, you know, they're, you know, address it with these things constantly, and injury and illness, and from viruses to bumps and bruises. And it's proven over and again, the science of it. And that's the true, you know, crime in it all, is the medical community really not acknowledging what this is really about. And this is not about this plant, this wacky weed, and, you know, crazy madness here with the reefer madness people want to continue to perpetuate. This is a, what it speaks to is the conversation that is being kept from us all. And that's how our human health is supposed to operate, and what we're made of. And what we're made of, they've acknowledged, is water, right? And a little bit of other elements. And the one thing they leave out is that we're also made of these cannabinoids. and this system that operates our entire being and body. And around the world, in many countries that have researched cannabis and been funded by our own government, including Israel, have acknowledged the endogenous cannabinoid system as the number one regulatory system in the human body. And so as you sit there and everybody and all your listeners sit there and go, wait, what is it you're saying? My entire body operates on cannabinoids? Yes. And that's the truth. And that's what they're keeping from us all. They could pull it straight out of you, right from your veins. They could pull it out of your body, just like mine. And these pharmaceutical companies are dead set on trying to create synthetic cannabinoids. Their number one focus right now. And drugs like Regeneron and all these others that are out here now and all these things that people are addressing cannabis with these pharmaceuticals that these companies are coming out with, have cocktails with all of these synthetic cannabinoids in them.
And you're right. There is sort of this still stereotypical get your pot, you got a surfboard and long hair and right on, man. as opposed
yeah,
to...
Yeah, sorry. I don't have that problem anymore.
Yeah, the hair's gone, but that stereotype does exist where it's like surfboards, California, right on, man, smoke and have a toke and take a nap, and as opposed to the medical value of it all, is the pushback, do you think it's the pill business, the you say pharmaceuticals, but everyone's got their pills and the big companies don't want that to go away, do they?
Well, they're drug dealers at the end of the day. I understand this well. People who've been addicted to opiates understand this very well, that these people are drug dealers. And I've been in that world since I was a young kid growing up in Southern California. All my friends were underground drug dealers and growing up a surf and skateboard kid. So I understand what these people are up to and why they're doing it. They're doing it for money. You don't kill 13 million people for a good reason, right? The Sackler family, one family responsible for OxyContin, killed 13 million people. A Jewish family, mind you, who likely had people lost in the Holocaust. So these are clearly people who have chosen to choose money over providing something to people of benefit. All of these drugs I was on masked everything that I was experiencing, did not heal any of it, not one. I have replaced every one of those medications with a plant that I'm growing in my backyard here.
Did you get addicted? And people don't realize you were post-football because of the pain, the injuries, you were prescribed medication, right? And then found yourself addicted?
100%. That's how it happens. It only takes one. They keep saying this now still. Well, they really backed off on the opiate stuff, Kyle. They're really doing a good job in the locker room, they tell me. You know, you can't just go get a bottle of pills anymore. I'm like, it only takes one. You guys are not getting it, okay? It only takes one experience, one injection of heroin. Why do you think that's different from OxyContin? It's not. It is the same thing. Johnson & Johnson just settled a few years ago a $1 billion lawsuit because they got caught smuggling opium in from Australia to America to put in our opiates through a company called Naramco. These companies are the companies that supply all of the drugs, and they're responsible for these things. And they have opium and cocaine and all these other things going into all these other drugs. And they know it because they need these people to get addicted. They are drug dealers. That is all they are. I've replaced every medication with a plant. And so has Ricky. So has Jim McMahon, Eben Britton, and on down the line of all the guys that we are growing in our community, especially the sports community. And it is going to be, a group of people that'll have to be reckoned with, because you know what? We've also found that this has given us our life back, and we've put that energy into all these creative ways that actually are doing really well. And we're all involved in businesses from my companies and NeuroXPF, CBD, Revenant MJ just came out with that line. We're crushing it all across the state of California and all the shops now. Ricky just started his brand Heisman, H-I-G-H. And, these are things that are helping people, and everybody's having an awesome experience being a part of. And a very minimal side of that is what people think it is. I was just at a huge convention in Northern California. Didn't have a problem knowing that I was going to San Francisco and I'd be dealing with all this madness with the masks and vaccines and whatnot. And the cannabis community still showed out to a stellar event, and nobody's dealing with any of this because we understand what human health is. It's not about getting high.
I couldn't help but notice, one of your email address had a little bit of a reference in there to a flying helmet here or there. And I'm like, this is the guy who has got a sense of humor, obviously. And I'm just thinking, I laugh when I saw it. Were you always outspoken? Were you always kind of emotional?
I don't know. I mean, I've always stood up to bullies. That's one thing I can say. My entire life has been kind of, I guess, around that. They wrote a whole huge feature article after I threw the helmet to try and, break down my psyche. What's Kyle thinking? What's going on with this guy? Why is he doing this, right? They leave out CTE, and of course, they don't want to talk about that. So they go back to, what makes up a person who doesn't have the ability to control themselves, and their responses to these moments that continue to present themselves to everybody in life, where you either fight or flight. And I'm a fighter, and I see situations like this that are truly life-changing. I can honestly say that cannabis saved my life, period. I'm here for this. This is my purpose because it has saved me and has saved so many other people, down to my daughter who just got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and was sitting in an A1C that was like off the charts that would have killed anybody, the doctor said, 500 to 600 count blood sugar level for over a month. They said, we didn't know what was going on with her. And then finally doctor said, you got to go to the emergency room. And we had the shock of knowing and understanding our daughter's about to die, but didn't, and went through every scenario that these doctors explained to us of that this should have been her life. She should have been in a coma for sure. These kids that have this don't make it as bad as she was. And they said, what are you doing with her? And we told them, and we always tell them, we give her CBD every day. And they said, we're hearing a lot about that. And these doctors continue to give that backhanded, acknowledgement to it, from them to, the NFL. I mean, I spoke to those people. They invited me to come talk to them. I gave a PowerPoint presentation to the entire medical board of the NFL, atop the Marina Del Rey Marriott, looking over all of Los Angeles. And that's why they stopped testing players. But they're still slow rolling it and backhanding it. They got a guy in their board that's a reefer madness kind of, I'm for cannabis, but we've got to wait and know more about the science of, something that's been around since 3000 BC, healing people and not killed anyone, period.
And it's insane. And you mentioned,
I can't, how does Kyle Turley not throw that helmet? while all these people out here being, oppressed and made to look like a bunch of stoners and hippies. I'm in the gym every day. Now I'm coaching. I got guys, I'm coaching the NFL, putting guys in college. I've started now 2 multi-million dollar companies. My marriage, I'm still here in my house, for God's sake. And, that's people, our community. Let's go over it. You know the story. So let's go over this last year of football dealing with CTE. Mass murder, suicide, overdose. Multiples. How many kids this year have died in youth football, Martin? 15 families have lost a child because of a sport of football, and we're masking children in classrooms, putting vaccines in people for 99.9% survivable viruses. That's like telling the greatest defense in the NFL history to just go block the water boy on when the quarterback snaps the ball. We're clearly living in insane times. And
are the high school kids dying? You mean because they got CTE or they acted out because of CTE?
No. Oh, there's then those suicides as well that have occurred that you can tack on to it, of all the youth football players and college football players and NFL football players and semi-pro football players that have committed suicide this last year, to the youth football players, which is a statistic that has ran since Pop Warner was created, that 15 to 20 kids die every year in youth football from traumatic brain injuries. And another 15 to 20 kids, youth football only, it doesn't happen because we know the science behind the brain, and that it's developing in youth. And that's why Bennett O'Malley calls it child abuse, because you're willingly putting a child into a situation where they're receiving a disease that is very progressive and very damaging in CTE. It has been shown through the studies. I've been a part of myself. And we've talked about it other times. And the NFL is keeping this information from people. 100%. They're denying me the opportunity to see my brain scans from a study I was a part of back at Massachusetts General Hospital, funded by the NFL. Over 10 football players were inducted in the study. They produced a paper on it, printed it in the National Institute of Health's website about this serum that they can inject into people and light up CTE in a living brain, and they can see it. And those doctors sat me down and they told me straight to my face that they can see it. And they know that anyone and everyone that's played this game has this disease at a certain degree. And when I asked them, I said, well, how old's my brain then? Because they obviously did the study on people other than football players, because they extracted us from it and put everybody else's in the paper that they produce on this serum called F18. Look it up. Google F18 serum. I got injected with that on two different doctor's visits. Messed me up for 2 weeks after each one, because the dye that they is so serious. It's radioactive material. It's, as they told me, the equivalent of walking around the earth for 9 years. I did that, injected myself with that thing twice. These guys know that I have this disease. They know the diagnosis these guys have given me is real, and that I'd be in a home right now if it wasn't for this plant. So, you know, I've got my reasons.
What do you think the football solution is, though? Like, for kids, just no tackling? I mean, do you think football needs to go away? What's the answer?
Cannabis. That's the answer. It's a neuroprotectant. There are unbelievable studies that show we can't stop being Americans. If people want to participate in riding, I grew up a surfboard skateboard kid. I'm hitting my head all the time. I could have got CTE from any number one of these things I did growing up being a human running around this world. Okay. It's not restrictive to only football players. I've given a lot of people peace, including families you talk about, I'm working on a deal right now. We're going to make a whole series like American Horror Story on how many guys from playing football are in prison for murder and all these other things, where you give these people an understanding of what has happened to them, from people that are homeless on the street to NFL football players. You ask them, was there ever an opportunity where you can say to me right now that you hit your head and had a severe head injury? And every one of them has. Yeah, I went through my wife's uncle went out of nowhere, just lost his mind, everything, and tried to kill himself. Wife, two kids, beautiful family, money, everything. Tried to kill himself. Whatever happened to him? What happened to Bob? Did anything happen to my father-in-law? You know, I asked him this question. He said, yeah, Bob went right through the front windshield of my car on my bachelor night. We hit a tree. And then I run into a homeless kid out there getting a tattoo, and he's coming in asking for water in California, and he's rambling around. He's drugged out of his mind. I say, hold on a second, man. I'm just going to ask you, did you ever have a head injury when you were growing up, or anything recent or just something come off top of your head. Yes, a beer head injury. He said, why did you ask me that? I'm like, because I just tell me. And he said, I got hit in the head with a baseball bat in Little League. These things are real. They're happening to everybody. Cannabis is the answer. I don't know how much more I can, you know, speak about it in the cognitive things that has resolved in me, where I was experiencing vertigo constantly, daily, losing my mind all the time. Still am. And this is the answer. And the science behind this as a neuroprotectant, the government has a patent on it as such. They own a patent on cannabinoids as neuroprotectants. There's study after study that those who have cannabis in their systems are over and above likely to survive a traumatic brain injury and not need surgery, not go into coma. I've given CBD to people who have been in comas that the doctors have told their families that they're going to pull the plug, or they need to decide to, because they're not waking up and they're going to be a vegetable for life if they do. Literally woke those people up in 30 minutes with putting CBD under their tongue in a coma, because it absorbs through MCT oil and these things that we use to help get things into people's systems rapidly. You don't have to smoke it. Doesn't have to be about THC or getting high or any of these other things. And again, it's about what's inside of you and your body operating that they could totally resolve. You know, we can go to stem cells after I resolve cannabis, and that's where I'm headed, because I put my two kids' umbilical cords with a company called Cord Blood Registry, which is owned and operated by a guy who went to Washington State University and I reached out to because of my friend Steve Gleason sitting in an unbelievable situation, who just spoke in front of the Louisiana State Legislature and explained to them that he would be a dead man long time ago if it wasn't for cannabis, and that cannabis is the one thing that's kept him from using these deadly opiates and drugs to deal with that disease on top of everything else. I mean, you know, we are, that's why I call this new company I started Revenant. We're the Revenant. We're getting our lives back. These people can't take it from us. And we're doing nothing wrong. These things are known by the science community. These other drug cartels are very powerful people. They're funded by very powerful sources. And I guess God put us here to go after him. So that's what we're doing.
How about a couple of football thoughts? You've had, you know, fascinating career. I'm thinking San Diego State, even, you come out, you're the 7th overall pick. You would have been a few years after Marshall. Was Marshall Faulk like a junior when you got there? Did you have a year together?
Yeah. It was his last year. So I redshirted, and so I was on the scout team. And so I got to block for him or play defense against him when the, you know, number one offense was needing us to throw around. And so I was going defense and offense in the scout team, figuring out what I'm going to do and what position I'm going to play. And then he declared early for the draft. And so, you know, that disrupted the whole program. And, we all started over after that. Al Luganbill got fired right after Marshall declared for the draft. And it was really cool to come back to St. Louis and get traded up there and be able to play with him and Oz, you know. And, it was awesome to finally be able to block for Marshall. You know, he was my inspiration. That was when I got to San Diego State. I played 1 year of high school football. I got a scholarship. I grew up surfing and skating, and I just decided I'm going to commit myself. I committed to wrestling. That was my sport. I probably could have went to college at that. I had people looking at me, but I grew up in a real poor town in Moreno Valley, California, out in the valley, you know, blue collar. My dad's a truck driver, 5 kids. We didn't have nothing. I know what a welfare Christmas is. And, so I was going to get a job, and I just decided to throw my dart, and it landed on the bullseye, man. When I got to San Diego State, I saw this little guy everybody was talking about, Marshall Faulk. I mean, his nickname was Huggy Bear. He'd never worked out. I don't think he ever lifted a weight, and probably still hasn't. And it's the most amazing athlete I've ever played with. And the smartest guy on the football field. And I just looked at this little guy everybody's talking about when I got there. I'm like, are you kidding me? No way. I'm like, this is it. I'm like, this is my calling. I'm going. You know, nothing's going to stop. This guy can come out of San Diego State and be a first-round draft pick. I can come out of San Diego State and be a first-round draft pick. That was my whole motivation at San Diego State because, you know, I saw what that was like because of Marshall. And I was like, man, I want that.
We did his Sunday night show for a couple of years. He would come in, and he's got a bag of McDonald's, like two Big Macs, two fries. And I said, right. Dude, I said, how are you eating that? And he goes, you score 5 touchdowns a day? Then don't worry about it. And I was like, okay. And how about Mike Ditka? Did you guys hit it off? Were you and Ditka, did you hit it off immediately or did it take a while?
No. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was just full respect on my end. It's Mike Ditka, of course. And, you know, I was a respectful kid, blue collar kid from a poor background. So, you know, the opportunity that he gave me, I did everything I could to give it back to him, you know, and I did, you know, but he didn't have the rest of the coaching staff there to really benefit us. And then we just went through a turnstile of quarterbacks. You know, I played with everybody, I think, that ever played quarterback for any team in the late 90s in New Orleans for 2 years. We had everybody come through there. And I mean, Mark Bolger and I were there. Hazlitt brought him in. But Dicker was a great guy, great man, you know, one of those guys that literally, you know, like you and I, and you could just call him still to this day and he's going to pick up the phone, you know, send them a message. He'll get back to you. Just one of those special guys. I mean, I saw the things that he did for people. He was a hard ass. He did everything 100 miles an hour from spending money to coaching and, you know, playing the game. So it was impressive and I was just in awe every day of I'm playing football for Mike Ditka, you know, no matter how bad it was, no matter how I didn't like what he said, even in the later parts of my career where he was an analyst and I was in Kansas City and one of the coaches from Kansas City said, Kyle, did you hear what Mike said about you? I think he was trying to get me fired up, you know, for the game that he said, you're a right tackle, not a left tackle. Cause Willie Rofe retired right before the season and I got thrown in the fire. Kyle, can you help us out? I'm like, I just came off this back injury and earned a spot as a backup tight end here. I'm supposed to sit behind Tony Gonzalez and Jason Dunn, maybe getting 10 snaps a game. And now I'm going to play 70 at left tackle, you know? So Mike, you know, that's what he's representing to the people, right? He knows my story. And, you know, that was the catalyst though, that drove me to then go into what more Mike was saying about retired players. And then I got involved and gave him a game check right after, you know, I had coaches telling me he's, you know, dogging me on the TV, you know, I'm like, no, I know that dude cares about me. That's why he says anything about me. And that's been the case, you know, and the whole relationship has been real special.
And right after Ditka, another former player, another kind of a hard-ass player was Hazlitt. And then it just kind of took off. And for a couple of years there, the Saints were really good and the Rams were really good. And Hazlitt and Martz like hated each other. At least we thought they did. How fun was that intensity of that rivalry?
It was awesome. It was an awesome rivalry. We hated each other. It was just a battle royal every game. And it was awesome. I mean, that was what won us the first playoff game in team history was we were playing the Rams and we couldn't lose that one. You know, it was in our house. So it was one of those real good rivalries that I thought helped, you know, St. Louis. I didn't understand why they got rid of that one because people could travel from New Orleans, you know, up there. And we were developing a great, you know, back and forth kind of thing there. You know, just I-55, right? And straight down for everybody. And it was kind of like becoming a college football experience between our rivalries, which was awesome. And, you know, we were both in the NFC West or something like that. You know, I thought they should have, you know, continued that. And that would have helped the Rams stay in St. Louis more, you know, playing teams like that. I don't know. It was awesome, though.
Did Haz ever talk shit about Martz, like, in the meetings during the week and kind of to get you fired? These guys think they're better than us and all that stuff?
Oh, yeah. And then the Rams played Super Bowl, you know, down there in New Orleans and they were using our facility. and Hazlitt was like, I think he said something to me like, Kyle, I said something to Mike Martz, you know, like reached out to him and told him, hey, anything you need, this, that, and the other, love to, you know, do anything for you, help you guys out while you're down here. And he was just a real jerk to me, you know, or something. It was, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was just the real, that's why I was surprised that they traded for me. You know, I was surprised that they were, they wanted me up there, but as we now know, in some ways, I think was brought there to get rid of Mike. In you know, roundabout, that's the way it played out, at least.
Well, and you got there to St. Louis, and the Rams were still really good that first year. You're a playoff team, a division winner, and then the whole that was kind of in the transition of Bolger, Warner, and you were there, and you famously said, "This is our quarterback." I think it was an ESPN postgame interview or something.
Yeah.
Was it ever awkward for guys in the room with Bolger and Kurt both there?
Yeah, it was real awkward. You know, I didn't appreciate it. Neither did any of the guys. We all knew that Kurt, you know, was coming back from injury, and we all knew how to deal with that. And that's not the way to deal with it, is to sit on the bench, you know, and let somebody else get in there. It was the beginning of the season, and Kurt had the, you know, it was his job, and he didn't lose it. And I think there was a lot of play calling going on that, you know, didn't really go his way. And I think we were playing the Giants up in New York, and I kicked the crap out of Michael Strahan. I destroyed Michael Strahan that game. I got, because when I played with the Saints, he kind of got me. We played the first game back after 9/11. And I'm going against Strahan, and I was just fired up. It was a war, you know, all the cameras around, Mel Torme singing the national anthem, those first responders, everywhere. The environment was electric, you know. I was just pacing the sidelines, just mad dogging him, like, we're going to war today. You know, he's the best in the league. I was trying to make a name for myself, and had a great game against him. We lost ultimately, like we did with the Rams up there, but you know, got some, but he definitely got me a couple times. And I, you know, had those, you know, as an offensive lineman, when somebody gets you, you know, it's rare when they get sacks and all these things. And so you don't forget those. And then the next time you play them, you do your best to take that out on them. And that was my opportunity. And so I prepared so heavily for that game. I knew I'm going, you know, I got Kurt Warner behind me. I'm here with the Rams. Like, I've got to show up. And destroyed Michael Strahan, threw him around like a rag doll. You know, he still to this day tells me to my face that I'm the, you know, the best guy he played against, because that game, and I was so ready to do my job for Kurt and the rest of the team, and I was out there, and I could tell, you know, we weren't calling the right place. And when you can destroy a guy like Michael Strahan and make him quit, I think, in the half, second half, you know, the coach took him out, and I was going against backups the rest of the game. And you got a guy like Kurt Warner back there, you're not calling the right damn plays at the end of the day. If I'm owning Michael Strahan, and you got – do we need to question what was going on the other side of the line with Big O? No. And the interior, guys, they weren't getting to him. We weren't getting to him. We were giving him plenty of time, and I could clearly see that there was a personal issue going on. And then when it happened, it happened. And in football, you've got to move on. And, you know, Mark's our guy, and he was a young guy, you know, and I knew the talent that kid had from being with him in New Orleans. Hazlitt brought him in. And so, you know, he needed that support. And as a lineman, that's my job. And so when I was running off the field there, and they're interviewing, I can't remember who it was interviewing them, and, you know, just let everybody know, this is our guy. Did you see him play today? You know, this is our quarterback right here. Look at him, you know. And people took that the wrong way, and, you know, in some ways that, oh, who's this new guy coming in, and, you know, what we've done here. You know, I think a lot of that animosity from the rivalry ruffled a few feathers and made people think I wasn't supportive of Kurt, you know, and that was unfortunate, you know, because I was really prepared to win another Super Bowl for that, you know, with that guy and help him do his job I could clearly see that that wasn't being allotted to him.
Was it a soap opera at Rams Park? Is it more than any other NFL? Or is every team a little bit dysfunctional?
Yeah, especially when you get into the management side of it. You had Jay Sigmund, Charlie Army, and then Mike Martz. And they were all, you know, it's business. And I understand that now out in the real world as a business guy. And you got to make decisions. And then all that pressure. And you can't just be the guy that all the guys said Mike Martz was the greatest coach until he became a head coach. He always fought for the players. He always helped the guys, took care of the guys, this, that, and the other. And that, as the years went by, I noticed that with a lot of coaches, you're under a lot of pressure being a head coach. And then that scenario there, it was very clear that, I mean, in my injury situation, I was in direct communication with Jay Sigmund constantly about my back injury and rehab and what was going on. Mike Martz was a coach who didn't want injured players around. And so made us sit in the stands, you know, be away from the team. Didn't want anybody around if you were injured. That was really unfortunate because I had a lot to give the guys that were backing me up and they needed my help. And I could have helped those guys on the sideline, but he wouldn't allow me to. So I left and I went and got rehab in L.A. And the approach that those people took was to take a bunch of weight off me and, you know, redevelop my core strength and all these things. That ultimately got me back to football without another back surgery. And, you know, my back's horrible now, because I didn't go get that other back surgery, but you know, I knew I could push through if I learned a few new things and how to get myself back. And core strength was non-existent when I was in college. All we did was power lift and squat 600 pounds and bench press 600 pounds and, you know, throw 600 pounds everywhere. It's like, there's nobody on the field that weighs 600 pounds. I don't, a couple guys tried to be that big, you know, but I learned about core strength and all those things and that got me back. I played 2006 season at 270 pounds at left tackle. And I had 8 games under my belt that were very good games. I was player of the game for the team a couple times, destroying guys out there. Cause I was more powerful, explosive, all these things I learned that, you know, being away from the team and listening to those idiots that were, it got me into that situation in the first place by telling me, oh, all that hip pain and leg pain is, you know, let's just shoot it up with cortisone. That'll fix it. And we'll figure it out after the season. Well, it's probably just a herniated or a bulging disc that I could have mended and maybe taken off a week or two, you know, to let it relax a bit more. And it maybe not would have herniated, you know, I don't know, but I know I could have dealt with that a lot differently and they could have as well. And he didn't like where I went and got my second opinions and got involved in it personally. And then started spouting off the media. And I went to Jay Sigmund and I was like, hey man, why is this happening? Can you please go with me to Mike and sit down and say what, tell him that you know what's going on with me? And, you know, because him and my agent were friends and he knew everything that was going on with me. Mike didn't know anything. And so it became this thing, I think, between he and I that he was associating me with Jay Sigmund and they were at it. And I got pulled into it. I was a young man. I had no right being pulled into that. Those guys completely used that against me to get me out of there. Ultimately, for Mike Martz, that was his desire. You know, I don't know how you sit there and tell a guy, you know, that you're never going to play for me again, no matter how hard you try to get back, and expect a non-rebuttal, you know, that isn't a little bit controversial and something that you're not going to be liking, you know, to hear.
When they write the book about the St. Louis Rams, there will probably be a chapter in there where Kyle and Mike, I'll never forget, because you were doing our Fox 2 pregame show. I wasn't there that Sunday. Maybe I was on the road and Rob Dazier was hosting and they play the clip of Mike that week. And he just says, I don't know where Kyle is. Haven't seen him, have no clue. And then you're like, dude, I've been right here. And then it led to the Monday night where you were in his office and you guys had a big exchange. And I think he said, you're not going to be here next year. And you said, well, maybe you won't either or something. Right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, got into it. And it was only because the, you know, Jay Sigmund wouldn't come with me to go talk to him. And
to clean
and
it
then,
up.
Yeah. You know, he was able to call and make up a big old story. I tried to kill him or something. Like, really? There'd be a sign of a struggle in that office. I'd
I forgot I tried about to do that, part. Oh my gosh. Would you ever write a book? Do you ever think about it?
Yeah, I have thought about it. Sure. You know, my stuff's in my music. You know, I went into music after and moving to Nashville. And so I just tell people, go buy my records. You can listen to my songs and know everything that's happened in my life, period. And I don't, you know, I could write a book and maybe one day I will, but what for? You know, I mean, if you can't really express to people in your feeling, you know, what it is, I don't know how they can read that and get that. So, you know, and it's personal. You know, I've had guys that try to write books with and they just don't get it, you know? So I'd have to sit down and really write it myself.
Yeah, you are, you know what? The answer is, I've answered my own question here. You are an open book. There's no need to write it. You are.
That's right. I'm pretty sure everybody can agree to that. Hey, I've not hit anything from anybody.
It's always fun to catch up. Next time we'll break down the game of the week or something, but I probably won't do that with you. So it's fine.
Hey man, I'm ready. I always follow it. You know, football's my life. You know, maybe they'll do a football story, you know, one day, and that'll be where everybody gets to see it. They've done their best though to extract me from the game. It's pretty funny, man. It's like I didn't even exist to the Rams, to the Saints, you know, the Chiefs. I was 2 years of me struggling, but those people actually have, you know, been the most accommodating team, you know, that supports me. I'm not on one team for the Saints over history anymore. Or I think the Rams, they've completely extracted me. It's hilarious.
Well, keep fighting the fight.
You know, always will, brother. At the end of the day, it's the last man standing.
Well, I got to tell you, if you're sitting at the bar and Kyle Turley walks in, you could sit and talk to him about anything. You want to talk about music? He backed a band for a while, then he started recording some music. We never even got into his musical career or interest. Time at San Diego State, I'd forgotten about that he and Marshall Faulk sort of overlapped briefly, and then got to St. Louis, wanted to block for Marshall. And then Steven Jackson comes along at some point. So many different topics, so many things you can talk to Kyle about. Don't have to agree with everything he says, but man, he is convicted in all of his beliefs. The Kilcoin Conversation, always available on Spotify, iTunes, and ScoopsWithDannyMac.com, the great Cardinal broadcaster website, ScoopsWithDannyMac.com. We always appreciate you supporting our sponsors, which include Triad Bank, Appliance Discounters, Marie de Villa, Senior Living, and B&G Tuck Pointing. Make sure when you do business with them, you tell them you've heard Martin talking about them for years. Thanks for checking out this segment. We'll talk to you again soon.